game. So I hope we can see you guys at a more full SPC TPE meeting soon. But this is sort of a special focused meeting where we're going to focus on EPAs and new developments. So I want to start by introducing Dr. David Turner. David is the Vice President for Competency-Based Medical Education at the American Board of Pediatrics and is leading a lot of the entrustable professional activities that has happened to date and the ones that will take place going forward. Following that, Kerry Carter, who is the Secretary Treasurer of our group, will follow up, and hopefully I'll bring it home with some updates on the new standardized evaluation project that is ongoing. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to David.
Great. Thanks, Lowell. Thanks for the nice introduction and for the opportunity to chat with all of you tonight. So, can you see my screen okay? Okay, great. So, I have about 20 or so minutes of content. And one of the things I'm responsible for is in my part of the presentation is do some level setting. And for those of you that some of these terms might be new or have differing levels of exposure to either competency-based education or EPAs or both, provide some definitions, do a little bit of level setting, and then set up Kerry and Lowell for some additional discussion about where things are going in the future, particularly in pediatric cardiology. So, just to get started, what is CVME and how does it fit into the future? So, historically, there's been this approach to certification that is relatively separate from what happens in GME training programs. And at the board, our role is individual certification. All of your roles as program leaders is preparing people to be individuals out in practice. And what we have learned over time is that there's increasing overlap, certainly in the goals and in the work to be done. And really, competency-based medical education fits squarely in the center of that. I think some of that is shared responsibility. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that in the next couple of slides between programs, us as a board, and a variety of other organizations and groups. Some of it falls on us as a board, and some of it falls on you as programs. But at the end of the day, this is really about partnership to help learners achieve the outcomes that we have defined that are important for them. And EPAs represent the foundation of a competency-based education framework. And that is the way that we as a community have defined what it is we want our learners to achieve. And I'm going to do a few more definitions of EPAs and show some examples in just a few minutes. But if you think about what is CVME beyond EPAs, it's really made up of five components. And I'm not going to go through these in a lot of detail, but really the first one is probably the most important one, right? So that's the framework, the foundation that you've established that really is the how you decide both what we're going to assess and what we're going to teach. And the EPAs represent the activities people are trying to achieve. And then the comprehensive framework that includes the competencies and milestones, and we're going to talk about how all these pieces fit together, is really the core of what it means to sort of start a CVME approach to education and assessment. And then this part in the middle is really the part that happens in GME training programs. So all of you as fellowship program directors are responsible for deciding how you're going to sequence your competencies and your rotations, how you teach, and how your learners learn to achieve these outcomes that we have established. And this is work that we as the board are definitely interested in partnering with all of you on, and some of the work that we're going to touch on that Lowell helped lead with the mapping, and there's some other examples, really serve as examples of how that partnership can be realized and come to fruition. And then the final piece is this idea of programmatic assessment. Programmatic assessment is just sort of a education speaky way to say use lots of data sources from lots of different people to make decisions about learners. Which is what all of you do as a part of your training programs every day. And it's something that we as a board want to make sure that we're paying attention to as we think about the future of education and assessment. And so EPAs, I've touched on these a couple of times. So their entrustable professional activities is what EPA stands for. I've been working on rebranding these over the last year or so as everyday pediatrician activities because that resonates a little bit better with the community. What they really are the activities that patients need that define a set of expectations for, in this case, for a group of learners or a group of pediatric cardiologists in training. And they serve to integrate the competencies. And we're going to talk about this integration in a much more concrete way towards the end of the presentation. But it's important to remember that EPAs don't really represent a new concept. They're not a new idea. And they're certainly not just another assessment tool. So the EPA itself is the activity that we expect someone to do. Now, how you assess and how you decide someone is ready to execute that activity without supervision is a large part of your responsibility as program directors. But at the end of the day, defining the activity that someone should be able to do is really what the EPA served to do. So they're not some new idea. They really just represent a formalization of better defining what we as a community feel the outcomes of training should be and what should be expected of pediatric cardiologists in practice. And so what that does is when you take them as a whole, is EPAs really serve to define the specialty broadly. So they're based on these patient needs. They can serve as a guide for both curriculum and assessment. So most of the conversation today is going to be on the assessment side of the equation. But it's also important to note that as you're thinking about these activities and having people prepared to be doing them, they also should be a part of the curriculum that you build. And that's the way we think about them when we build our assessments that we as a board conduct. So when we create the content outlines in each of our subspecialties, we start with the EPAs as the beginning of that process. And then we pull out the multiple choice testable content that then become our assessments, the initial certification exam, MoCA-Peds, and all of those ultimately stem from these core activities that we've established for each subspecialty. And so, what are the EPAs in a concrete way? So, these are the seven EPAs in brief that were defined by the community that apply to all subspecialties. So, as you look at these, hopefully, these activities will resonate both as things you do in practicing pediatric cardiology and also that apply to other specialties, subspecialties across pediatrics. And you can see this is a mixture of important clinical activities like consultation. It's hard to imagine anyone as a subspecialist who is not competent at consultation. And then there are others that represent non-clinical activities like scholarship, leading within the profession. And it's also important to note that the EPAs were designed with the entire education continuum in mind. So if you think about fellow and fellowship training, I don't think anyone would expect a fellow who's graduating to be prepared to lead in the subspecialty profession. That's really an activity that develops after training, after years of experience, and as a part of the lifelong learning process. So as we think about eventually asking, you know, from you to attest readiness to execute the EPAs at the conclusion of training, clearly we're not going to be asking about their ability to lead in the profession, but for things like consultation and some of the clinically relevant activities for cardiology, those are the things that are really important as you're making that transition from fellowship into practice. And then your community came together to define six EPAs for pediatric cardiology, and I'm not going to read all of these to you, but if you look at them, your EPAs, in contrast to a lot of subspecialties, really align very nicely with the way most fellowship programs are structured. So your EPAs align, you know, there's an imaging EPA, there's a catheter-based intervention EPA, there's a rhythm EPA, which line up with the different clinical services and rotations that you often have in your fellowship training program, which also serves as a benefit as you think about the implementation piece of this, because as an you know, as an individual group of faculty within your division, you could see where the electrophysiologists are going to be able to focus on the rhythm EPA, the cath folks, and the interventionalists can focus on the catheter-based EPA. And there's obviously overlap depending on your area of practice and how your program is structured. But the EPAs as they currently are designed really line up very nicely with the curricular elements of a fellowship training program in pediatric cardiology. And what that ultimately will lead to is sort of where we plan to change our certification processes. What we currently do now and the inputs to initial certification are a license, completion of an accredited fellowship program, which all of you attest to. And our current attestation form is competency based, but it's based on the core competencies, professionalism, medical knowledge, patient care. And then we have the assessment exams, initial certification exam. Where we're going as a first pass is really making sure that we're preparing people along the way and that all of you are thinking about the EPA framework as you're doing your assessment so that ultimately the idea of attesting to readiness to EPAs is where we're headed. And then we also are having a lot of conversations right now about our process, what it means to certify, what that looks like, and in addition to integrating EPAs, what the future might hold. And there's still more to come there, but I only mentioned that to mention we, as we transition in with a new CEO coming in a week or so, and thinking about the future, are having a fair number of conversations about how our certification processes might evolve to better align with the competency-based approach to education and assessment. So that's just a slight teaser there as we think about where we're going for the future. One of the questions that I often get is why? Why do we need to do this? Why do we talk about CBME and EPAs? And do we have data to suggest that this is an important transition that we need to be making? One piece of data that is really important is that if you look at programs, and this isn't isolated to pediatrics, this is actually true across a wide range of specialties, competency committees are often making decisions with quite limited information. And there is this pathway that's been described in the literature as people are progressing along that sort of is this idea of the default pathway, right? So that unless a learner has red flags or has challenges, they're really trucking along. And they sort of are continuing along, sort of like a conveyor belt throughout their training process, unless someone pulls the lever because there's a concern that they need to stop. And that's one of the problems that we're trying to solve as we think about competency-based education and assessment is as early in the educational process as possible, make sure we're thinking about these activities that are relevant for patients and families so that then we can identify learners that have challenges and then make sure those get addressed earlier so that we don't have these situations where at the conclusion of training or near the conclusion of training, we recognize someone re needs remediation and we realize, oh, wow, we don't have enough time to get them where they need to go as they're making the transition into practice. And so this is one issue that's a challenge. And then there are some data on the EPAs that many of you may have participated in as a part of the SPIN study over the last couple of years, which looked at EPA performance over time. So this is just data from competency committees reporting EPA level of supervision for trainees. And this slide is data at the conclusion of training for subspecialty fellows across all of our pediatric subspecialties, asking the question, are they ready for consultation and what level should they be? So just to orient you to the slide, the y-axis is the percentage of learners in a given category. The x-axis is each level of supervision. So level five is unsupervised practice. So in a perfect world, everyone who's finishing a training program in a subspecialty should be ready to provide a consultation without supervision. So theoretically, everybody in this study should be in level five. As you can see, there's a big group of people that to some degree, their program directors felt there was some degree of supervision needed at the conclusion of training to provide a consult. Now, the level fours, so they're, almost a third of the people that are in level four are probably a mixed group of learners, right? So my guess is many of those people were probably ready for unsupervised practice, except in the most complex of cases, right? That's the way the supervision scale is written. And I think that's interpreted by many program directors in a part of this study as they're ready. They just, if they have a complicated patient after they transition, they're going to talk to a friend or a colleague or a former program director or someone in their division, but they're ready for practice. However, there also is probably a significant group of people in this category who actually still need genuine GME supervision for the complicated patients. And so teasing that out is something that I think we need to do over time as we learn more about the data and the EPAs. But clearly, the people to the left of level four, right? So the level threes and twos are requiring a degree of supervision that most would say is more than should be happening after training as a part of the early practice period. And so thinking about how we take all of those people and we move this curve to the right is really fundamentally the problem that we're trying to solve. Because with CBME, as we think about defining the outcomes, and if you think back to those activities that you defined as a subspecialty as important for pediatric cardiology, we really want to set the floor, right? We want to set the floor in that everyone is ready to do these. They no longer need GME supervision. They're ready for practice. None of them are experts, right? Because expertise is clearly not the goal at the conclusion of training, because lifelong learning is an important part of being a subspecialist in every area. But we want to make sure everybody is meeting that floor. And right now, there are a number of people who aren't in a variety of different areas based on the data. And this is true across a wide range of subspecialties. And so that is the motivation behind why we plan to eventually, in the next 4 or 5 years, use EPAs as a part of the certification process. As I mentioned earlier, that's probably on first pass going to be at least in part through attestation from programs over time of progressive improvement in the EPAs, ultimately moving towards unsupervised practice. But we're still working through the specific details of what that's going to look like. And one of the reasons that we haven't specifically said, you know, this is exactly what it's going to look like, is we want to make sure that we learn from all of you, really across all the subspecialties, as to how we can do that most effectively to make sure that we collectively are achieving a shared set of goals around making sure that learners are ready for practice as they're leaving your programs and move out into the world to become certified pediatric cardiologists. Now, just to like tackle the elephant in the room, right? So anytime I'm talking about CVME and EPAs, one of the things that sort of pop to the forefront of most program directors' mind are the milestones, right? And so thinking about how does this work intersect with the competencies and the milestones, which is where you spend most of your assessment energy in the vast majority of our graduate medical education training programs. And really, instead of thinking about this as an either-or proposition, it's really quite valuable to think about a competency-based framework as a continuum with multiple components of assessments, with the ultimate goal being, is someone ready to execute an EPA? Which in this case, you can use the imaging EPA as an example, right? At the end of the day, this is the activity that's important for your learner's future patients, and these are the things that your fellows need to be able to do. And in order to do that, they have to integrate a lot of different competencies, right? Professionalism, communication, medical knowledge. And then within each of these categories, there are subcompetencies that have been newly announced, right? So these are the milestones 2.0, anatomy, physiology, transthoracic echo. And then underneath that, you know, there's a specific level of milestone that a learner can be tagged to. But at the end of the day, the milestone level that someone has achieved really only represents a means to an end, right? Because if someone can do the integration of anatomy and physiology that's defined on the milestone in the way that it currently is, that's important. And it's an important behavior to be able to do, but it's only important because it allows you to do something else, right? The something else being whatever it is a patient needs, which in this case would be the imaging EPA. And I think that's how the milestones, EPAs, and competencies fit together. And if someone is achieving their expectations and they're moving along and meeting EPA expectations as you would expect, then assessment for those fellows, we should try to make that as simple and as easy as it can be. And if they're not, then diving into the right side of the slide to say, what are your challenges? How can we help you remediate in these areas is really where you can spend your energy so that each individual gets an assessment and then a subsequent plan for learning that's really matched up to what they need so that ultimately everyone is progressing and they may progress at different paces. But at the end of the day, they're able to achieve a shared set of goals. And so one of the ways we want to make this process as easy as it can be is to streamline, right? And so that is work that Lowell, I think, is going to touch on in a little bit more detail. But he helped us lead a group of you. I think some of the people who were participants in this are also on the call, to map the EPAs to the newly released, which not so new anymore, Milestones 2.0. And so the goal there is that we can then use the EPAs to auto-generate a set of milestones for a learner that can be used for remediation plan, individual development of a fellow, ACGME reporting, all the various reasons that you would need to create a milestone list. And then in addition to that, and this is also going to get touched on in just a bit, the group is working on thinking about updates on the curriculum and shared assessment tools across the subspecialty. And I'm going to let others talk about that more specifically. But just a snapshot of what the mapping looks like. So this is the raw data. The EPAs are all listed along the left side of the slide on the y-axis. The x-axis, or across the file, are all the different subcompetencies and the milestone levels that match up. And like I mentioned, the goal is a system here to translate EPA ratings into milestone ratings. And so the 1.0 version of this, so this is a link that is now available that you can go to, allows you to choose an EPA. So in this case, you choose cardiology, EPA number one, level supervision five, and then it spits out to you this report, right? And you can see this like online in real time on the website. And you can see that you get a number of different subcompetencies that have been mapped and the milestone level that then you could use for your learner. It is important to remember, and I touched on this briefly a second ago, you know, if you choose level five, right? So that's unsupervised practice, and in this case, it's the imaging EPA. You can see the milestone levels here. None of the milestone levels are level five, right? And so one of the like learning points along the way that can be a little bit confusing, and there's some debate as to sort of why it was done this way. But what we mean when we talk about unsupervised practice, right? So unsupervised practice is ready to move out into the world, and you don't need a GME supervisor anymore. It's not an expert. And the way the milestones are written, level five is almost never achieved by a fellow in training, right? Because level five is generally designed to be aspirational in most circumstances. And so what you see is someone who is ready to execute an EPA without supervision, who's level five, their milestone profile is going to be somewhere in the 3.5 to 4.5 range, sometimes even lower, depending on what the milestones are and what the subcompetencies are, which is absolutely fine as long as they're able to achieve the activity in the way that we define as a community is necessary for practice. And the frame there, as we're thinking about readiness for EPAs, and I've touched on this a couple of times, is are they ready to practice without GME supervision? Yes, no. And you answer that question all the time in a global sense as you're letting your learners progress along and they move out into practice. But thinking about each of the individual EPAs allows a level of granularity that then you can make sure that for each of these things we've defined as a community as important, that people are ready to do as they're moving along. And a major consideration here, literally in every category, is, do they know their limits? Are they going to seek help when they need to? And those are things that are critically important skills for someone as they're making the transition into the life of an early subspecialist in practice. And so thinking about assessment, and Lowell's going to touch on this when you talk about your assessment forms, most assessments now look like these questions, right? What's the milestone level for this subcompetency or that? And the future version of assessment, at least one option for future version assessment, is much more supervision focused on activities that learners need to be doing. And the good news is that these are the questions that faculty and fellows find most relevant that they answer every single day. Like faculty make these decisions all day, every day, whether you're asking them on a form or not, right? Because if you're on the inpatient service and you get a consult in the emergency room for a baby with SVT and you're with a fellow, the question is, do I need to go with the fellow and be with them for the entire time? Can they go do it on their own and talk to me after the fact? Or somewhere in between? Those are entrustment decisions that are being made for an activity that faculty already understand how to do. And so changing assessment so that it's focused on these very meaningful and relevant types of activities is really the spirit of where we're trying to go with this. And just as I finish up, one thing to note, in case I don't remember to mention it, I put a slide in here. One of the things we are currently doing is we're piloting MOC Part 4 project focused on implementation of EPAs. So if you're interested in really like diving into this with both feet and implementing EPAs in your program and you want to pilot it and get MOC Part 4 credit for you and your faculty, let me know and we can talk about the specifics of that and how that might work in your program and how to set you up for success there. And where can you go today? So I think the first step in this is really learning about the EPAs, understanding what they are and what they mean for your specialty. And I think most people, when they read these, are like, oh, wow, like this does really resonate with me and what I think we should be teaching fellows to do. And we hear that over and over again from programs, faculty, and otherwise. And then just think about, and this is going to be a topic of much of the rest of the session today, how are they being used and how could they be used for rotations, objectives, orientation, assessment forms? And how do you really engage everyone involved in the education assessment process in thinking in these sort of clinically oriented and outcome-based terms? And one of the ways to do that is as an individual, when you take care of patients, sort of thinking about it in a concrete of way as possible, right? How much supervision are you providing a learner? And then why are you doing that? Like, what's the reason that you need to be directly supervising someone while they're doing a consult and then providing that feedback for the learner. Because at the end of the day, this bullet is probably the most important part of this entire process, more than anything else I've talked about, is really the ongoing conversation between faculty and fellows in a coaching and a developmental way to help them achieve success and be ready to perform these activities. That's really the heart of what we're trying to do. And yes, there's some like logistics involved, and there's some parts that we're going to collect as the ABP, and there's work to do as programs. But at the end of the day, like this growth and development piece is by far the most important part of a competency-based education framework. And then, as I mentioned before, if you're interested in Part 4, there certainly are ways to provide opportunities to gain Part 4 credit and get credit for work that you either are doing or will be doing already. And so, with that, I'll stop and I'll hand it over to Carrie and then Lowell to talk a little bit more. and then we'll hopefully have time for discussion and questions.
Yeah, I'm hoping that I'll provide the discussion jumping off point. I have far less formal things to say than David, and he might as well have taken the words right out of my mouth for a number of things. But so my perspective, I wear a number of hats at work. So I've got the cardiology fellowship, and then I'm one of the associate program directors for our residency program. So we're dealing with, more learners, more faculty, more people to sort of wrangle on all ends. And my role for the residency is clinical and professional competency and evaluation, and in particular, kind of early identification of the struggling learner and development of remediation plans and that sort of thing. So when Milestones 2.0 came out for general pediatrics, which is, whatever, a year ahead of most places. And we had the lovely experience of getting to experience that for the first time. I rewrote all of our regular evaluations for the residency program, which were previously sort of milestone based. And those of us that sat with Milestones 1.0 for any significant amount of time, I think many of us would agree that those items weren't necessarily the most approachable. Some might use the word esoteric for some of those things. It's difficult to make an assessment. And certainly if our evaluation tools were based on that, the faculty that aren't as familiar, are we really putting any meaningful thought into putting people on that milestone scale? I like the everyday pediatrician activities abbreviation for EPAs because I like to call them activities of daily living. I really think that the curricular subcompetencies that go along with those EPAs are very approachable things for both the faculty to assess as they're watching people, and also for the residents to take feedback on. I think it's an easily understandable concept for them to think about progressing through. I need a full-time babysitter when I'm doing X, Y, or Z to I can just talk to you after the fact. That scale is approachable, and I think is not intimidating. It's not, I don't think it feels as daunting for either the learner or the evaluator. So I'm hopeful that pulling folks into using some of these in sort of their everyday assessments will kind of open the feedback door, right? We want these things to be meaningful. The faculty have to sit down and do it, and we need their buy-in to get them to sit down and do it. If they're able to provide meaningful information that is easily understandable for the person who's getting the evaluation or is being evaluated, and those that are going to like make a final assessment about whether or not somebody's done enough to be able to go out into the, the big bad adult world, I think we owe it to ourselves and the folks that are helping us produce these doctors to make the tool meaningful for both the person doing the assessment and the person being assessed. So it's been an interesting process. Milestones 2.0 is much more approachable, but we're making the systems talk to each other, but in reality, they exist independently, and we use one for one set of things and another for another set of things. And I'm hopeful that we can sort of blend those two things and make it meaningful for everybody, in an approachable way.
Great. Thanks, Carrie. Thanks, David. Before I go on to the last sort of presentation part, and then we can have discussion and questions, just want to welcome people who joined late. We are recording this, so you can feel free to review the information that happened before you jumped on. On a personal note, I see some names that are a little unfamiliar to me. So if there's new program directors, new program associate program directors, new program coordinators, we hope to see you at a regular SPC TPD meeting and meet you either virtually or in person at the American College of Cardiology meeting. So with that, I do have a couple of visual aids, and hopefully this will augment what Carrie talked about and what David showed you. So what I'm showing you here is the results of the recent ABP project to take the EPAs, which have existed for about a decade, and map Milestones 2.0 to them. What you see here are the six cardiology specific EPAs, and what a committee of many program directors and interested others decided were the essential activities as a part of it. So, for example, imaging, we decided that transthoracic echo, not surprisingly, is essential. Knowing something about congenital heart disease is essential. Using evidence, being accountable, and communicating is a part of imaging. And we did that for all the six cardiology EPAs and the seven subspecialty, sorry, common subspecialty EPAs, which I won't show you visually. This is just a table representation of where the subcompetencies or milestones showed up. So patient management, not surprisingly, showed up in five subspecialty specific EPAs and one common subspecialty EPA, probably consultation if I recall correctly. Organizing and prioritizing patient care showed up one, I think we put it in the acute care, one maybe ICU, I don't recall offhand, and one common subspecialty. Every milestone, so all 23 milestone 2.0 were represented at least once. Except for well-being, which didn't show up anywhere. We can chuckle at our own field, but I think David will tell us almost every pediatric subspecialty had the same results. We need to figure out another way to assess well-being. So now I want to talk about tools. So really practically implementing these things in your program. So I'm starting with just a screenshot of what a group of, I believe some people on this call, did about 9 years ago with the original milestones. The goal was, this comes up a lot. We get a lot of emails that come to either Lori or Rupali or Carrie or Sinead or Lindsay Attaway gets a lot of these. Do you have goals and objectives that you would mind sharing with my program? Do you have evaluation tools you would mind sharing with my program? So part of the motivation was let's come up with a toolkit because we all have to evaluate our fellows. Let me see what somebody else is doing. I can adapt it, but I don't have to start with reinventing the wheel. So this is just a snapshot of the imaging form. There were some things that were good, but we learned a lot doing them. I know many of your programs use this at some point. A little over half the programs in the country use some form of these at some point. Some of them abandon them, move on, that's fine. But the goal is to have literally an evaluation tool that you use at the end of your rotation or however often you evaluate your fellows. So we want to redo this now that there's Milestones 2.0. So what are the motivations behind all this? Well, in a very Machiavellian, pragmatic way, we want to facilitate program director responsibilities of reporting the milestones to the ACGME twice a year. We have to do this, and so we want to make this easy. I would say that your residency management system, whether it's MedHub, New Innovations, or something else, can actually really help a ton. And a lot of the evaluations project relies on this functionality, and I'll show you guys a snippet of that. So, what else is the motivation? Like I said before, we all need evaluations, and we have a lot in common, so let's work together. And this is something that I think is really important. Both Carrie and David spoke to this, is it is one thing to say, ugh, more red tape for program directors, I need to report. But like our goal is to give formative feedback to fellows to help improve them, right? And I don't claim that evaluations are perfect. I know that speaking to a fellow, giving them one-on-one verbal feedback is probably the most valuable thing we can do, but written feedback is important in all situations as well. And we want these things to be granular. We want to improve on what we did about a decade ago. They were a little too long. Some of them were too granular. The correlation of the form question with the milestones was meh at best. Now that EPAs are going to be a part of initial assessment, initial certification, I'm sorry, we want to start to generate meaningful EPA-based assessment of trainees for them, for us, and for the American Board of Pediatrics. As David started his presentation out with, our field is uniquely suited to do this because, for the most part, a rotation evaluation form has a nearly one-to-one correlation with the six cardiology subspecialty EPAs. So, in a way, it's just breaking down the EPA, getting the building blocks of it, and putting it on one form. We want to improve the use of EPAs because there are those seven other common subspecialty EPAs: consultation, fiscal management, leading, et cetera, which we do care about in our fellows, we should assess them on, and we kind of left that out entirely of the first version of the evaluations. So this is just a visual schematic of really what the whole project is about. I'm sorry this is sideways, I couldn't fit on the slide. So if you take, for example, the imaging EPA, acquire all the skills needed for imaging. This correlates with cardiology EPA number one, and it includes a couple of relevant common subspecialty EPAs. I'll get there in a second. We decided that the imaging form, because the EPA is mapped to these ACGME milestones, the form must have questions that at least include those five milestones. It can have more, but it must at a minimum have those. So each form is just a collection of questions on observable skills and behaviors. So do they know at least in my training, is not something that is easy to assess, right? I mean, you think you know, but it's like observable skills. Can they demonstrate? Can they explain? So we've this project started about 2 months ago. We've had roughly bi-weekly meetings, Wednesday night, next one is tomorrow night. And we've had a lot of debate, a lot of sort of relearning things, a lot of making sure we understand things. But there's really four types of questions that go on these forms. One is taking a milestone from Milestones 2.0 and dividing it into smaller parts. They're pretty granular, but for example, the transthoracic echo question, I'm sorry, milestone, has a performance aspect and an interpretation aspect. So he said it might benefit trainees to say, here's your scanning, here's your interpretation. You can do the study, but do you know what you're looking at, right? And so we broke that down into two questions. Generally speaking, for the individual levels, we just took the relevant descriptions from level 1 through 5 for Milestones 2.0. Again, don't reinvent the wheel. There are some things that are best to assess just verbatim, because as Kerry said, Milestones 2.0 are less esoteric. So, for example, accountability. We did not need to phrase that in an Echo Lab relevant context because it describes it pretty well. Are they accountable and professional, and what are the relevant milestones within that? And we basically just copied that verbatim. We did it for accountability. We also did it for evidence-based and informed practice. So it's near verbatim. So one is splitting them into smaller elements. One is just put the milestone on the form. Then there were some things that didn't quite fit with the milestones, but we thought were important. So for example, on the imaging form, of course, no surprise to the personalities in cardiology, the imagers wanted to ask about every last knob on the echo machine. But we are restraining ourselves. We did think having a question about you can take pictures, you can read an echo, but are you optimizing your imaging? Are they not a competent cardiologist if they don't do that? Of course they are still a competent cardiologist, but we thought that granular feedback to help them get better at that would be important. So this is related to a given echo milestone, but we have to write individual levels. What's a level one in optimizing the image? What's a level two, et cetera, et cetera. And then there are novel questions, but they're outside the scope of Milestones 2.0. So a lot of this is like fetal MRI. There is stuff they need to know about transitional and fetal circulation, but technically there's nothing they need to know about performing a fetal or counseling fetals. We thought having these questions would be valuable for trainees and those people interested in advanced skills. So for example, on the interventional one, most of that's about managing the patient who needs a cath, but we do have some questions on there about doing the cath. It doesn't mean they're not competent if they can't do it. We thought having a little bit of bonus was valuable. So this is just taking the right half of the slide and moving on. So you have the four types of questions, and this is just my conceptualization of it. And then how they relate to the milestones, breaking them down verbatim, sort of on the same scale, but novel, and then novel and not related. And we're also mapping them to entrustable professional activities. Obviously, everything on the imaging form will map to EPA1, acquire the imaging skills. But some of them may map outside of that if it's, you know, for example, the acute care. So like your floor, your consults, whatever, we understand people's rotations are different, will not only map to the acute care EPA, but will map to the consultation EPA as well. What I hope everybody can take advantage of, and I'm very enthusiastic about this, is the functionality which it within your web-based platform. Because if you build it right, and I know both New Innovations and MedUp can do this, it will spit out a milestones-based report for either, depending on your preference, you to upload to the ACGME, you to give to your CCC, and they can modify. That's how we do it in Washington. And a lot of data, like for example, here's one I had for my fellows. This is the old milestones, provide transfer of care that ensures seamless transition. But for this fellow, their previous meeting, they were at a 3.5. Their evaluation, say this time they're a 4. Their average was a 4.1. They got scores ranging from 3 to 5. There were 6 different questions that filled that in, and we don't track comments or different evaluators. You can see for diagnostic decisions, there were 43 data points on there. So not surprising. I'm a big proponent of this. And this is just from the published work from what we did a decade ago. And you see, this is a pretty similar schematic as what I just showed you about how questions on a form relate to an EPA, relate to subcompetencies, and essentially how it all works out. Sorry. And then two last things I want to show you. This is where we're at. Sorry, for the work in progress. We have simplified the form. TTE performance. optimizing images, we're going to shorten it, and help for the evaluators, because the audience for the form is the general faculty who are evaluating fellows and the fellows receiving the feedback. So we want to make it short enough to read, but detailed enough to be helpful. And we have some work to do. You can see there's some edits here, but can you do an echo? Can you optimize the image? Can you communicate that data in written and verbal form? Are you accountable? That's obvious in everything, but we've cut it down. The rule is single digit number of questions and then a comments field. That's our North Star. The last thing I want to share, and then we'll open it up for comments and questions, is just what it really looks like under the hood. I might have timed out, but I'll show you that real quick. Actually, why don't we, I don't think that's so relevant. I want to leave generous time for questions. So why don't we, I see some things in the chat, and open it up for comments. If you're so inclined and you want to ask a question, unmute, turn on your camera, but you can keep your camera off if you're more comfortable. While we're waiting for that, I see Nicole's comment in the chat. Yes, correct. That is MedHub. It's really functional. My suspicion is that most of you, whether it's MedHub or New Innovations, actually have that and either chose not to because you didn't have like a MedHub or a New Innovations champion in your program, chose not to use it. It's actually really good. It's not perfect, but the technology platforms are really good. I would add that David's Tableau website he showed, where you do the reverse, you do a global assessment of how they are at imaging, and it spits out the five relevant milestone levels based on previous data from the SPIN study, is super fancy. So it's just two different ways of getting at it, and I think both will have utility for programs.
Cool, thank you. No, that looks helpful. I've never seen that option in MedHub, so I'll reach out to our coordinators.
Yeah, so this is Lori. I just want to say thank you to all of you. That was really excellent. My comment really quickly is to remind all of you that the SPC TPD has a new part of it that is the program coordinators are organized under the leadership of a woman named Ashley Harrison Faria, who is the current elected president. The point is that that group coordinates and they talk about this sort of thing together. And so there's a if your program coordinator is new or is not really well versed in any of this, they can speak within that organization and learn from other program coordinators who, like Lowell and Carrie and David, just love this sort of stuff and are experts at it. And I also just wanted to point out Carrie's comment up at the top there. This is extremely important if you do have a fellow who's not doing well and you're trying to give them, first of all, specific comments, but second of all, you're documenting these interactions and the remediation that you've been doing somewhat informally so that when it becomes formal, you have that foundation, to work off of.
If you're formulating questions, I can just show you what it looks like. Nicole, this might get at what you were curious about. This is the build for a question in MedHub, and New Innovations is pretty similar. So you write a question. This is the old milestones. So this is milestones 1.0. The question was selects and clearly presents a subset of images relevant to a patient's clinical status, such as in an educational or a case or surgical conference. And then you have the EPAs here. 1 through 6 are the cardiology specific EPAs. EPA 1 through 7 is the subspecialty specific. We've got to work on the naming. And then you just check off which ones does this question relate to. And you do the same for the subcompetencies, or more colloquially known as the milestones. And we decided this was related to the old ICS-1, communicate effectively with physicians, other health professionals, et cetera. We could sign up for more things, but we didn't. We have all the options right here. And then basically, your system will keep track of all these data points. It's nice. It actually works retroactively because we're in a little bit of a limbo period. I took our existing evaluations kind of by myself, just mapped the new milestones so I could get that nice progress report functionality. And as you change the mapping in the evaluation build, it'll update the database. So it really keeps a whole lot of stuff, as I like to say, under the hood. And in, an example of technology influencing our practice, this functionality drives a lot of what we're doing in the new evaluation project to maximize the functionality of the system. I see a lot of silence and black boxes. So we certainly are not obligated to go the full 60 minutes. So if there are no other questions or comments or thoughts about how people are using these or planning on using these, Carrie, David, any final comments?
No, I would just say keep the conversation open. I really believe in working smarter, not harder. And I think we're, you know, on the I'm not going to get the acronym right because I never do and it's late and I'm tired. We're really trying to make as many resources available. You know, we're all doing the same thing. We all have the same goal, right? Nobody should be double doing work that doesn't need to be double done. So, and please, 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 from the struggling learner perspective or like professionalism problems, having all that documentation there is so very important, even just from the perspective of, you know, the remediation plan said that the learner had to improve their whatever milestone score, EPA score by one full point by whatever. When you have documentation that they haven't met that expectation, the case just holds up so much better because nobody wants the disaster situation where you don't have enough evidence to let somebody go that shouldn't go any farther. Because it is just, it's awful. That whole process is just awful. So having the data there is so, so very important.
Yeah. And I'll just say, thanks for the opportunity to join and partner. And I think that, you know, the spirit of figuring out how to assess and let the easy fellows be easy, right? Because I think a lot of fellows progress as they would expect and making that process as simple as possible so you can focus your energy in the areas where the need is greatest to get everybody where they need to go is really like a big part of, I think, the work that Lowell and Carrie mentioned that they're trying to accomplish, which, you know, I think the more we can do to make the work, administrative work of a program director more efficient and help us achieve the goals of getting learners ready by the end. Like, that's the spirit of what we're trying to do.
David, I have a question for you. You just sort of hinted that this would be applied to faculty or to people in practice in the future, EPAs. Do you see when that becomes in practice, do you feel like division heads will use the same systems that we're setting up for fellows, or do you see something completely different?
It's a great question. I mean, I think the EPAs are designed to address the lifelong learning process. And I think particularly in a field like cardiology, where there's a fair amount of sub specialization that follows training, there's probably an opportunity there to think about how that, you know, becomes standardized across institutions, faculty, et cetera, not in a like make your life more difficult way, but to sort of make sure that, you know, the things that have to happen for maintenance of certification, continuing education, those kind of things really match up and align with what's most relevant and applicable to you as an individual for your practice. That is certainly a priority for us as we think about what we do as a board in our certification processes, is making sure that the, particularly the continuing certification space, is as relevant and directly applicable sort of value add to what you do as an individual faculty as possible. And hopefully that also translates into, you know, the work of division leaders. But the EPA framework overall is designed with that in mind so that you can really look at this as a lifelong learning process, recognizing that, you know, learning certainly doesn't end when fellowship ends. And any of us who are subspecialists recognize, like, you may have learned more in your first 2 years as a faculty than you did in all the years prior to that. And I think thinking about how to provide some structure there is also an important part of this.
I just ask because if that happens, that division heads are having to implement something like this, we'll be the experts for our programs, and they'll lean on us to sort of create, I would imagine they would lean on us to create something for the faculty as well. So that's, it's good to know that that's coming and motivation for us to all really understand this well.
Wonderful. Well, then thank you everybody for your time. We'll give you 8 minutes of your evening back. And I hope to see a lot of you guys at the ACC meeting and community day.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you.
Thanks again.